This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hello and welcome to Start Your Week from the Bunker, a media outlet which proudly lets its presenters tweet whatever they like. I'm Jacob Jarvis, and here with me today is Doomsday Watch host Arthur Snell. Good morning, Arthur. How are you?
I'm fine, Jarv. How are you?
Good. Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Arthur, on to some tangible stuff before we get into the madness, which we'll obviously have to get into. So, Arthur, it's the second reading of the illegal migration bill on Monday. The government's tried to ignore or distract from any scrutiny there. How do you think Sunak and Braverman will be feeling?
Well, I think they will have prepped a lot of their own MPs to stand up and say this is a wonderful bill. You know, the Lee Anderson tendency will, of course, be out in force. But then on the other side of the coin, there will be those in the opposition that try to bring real scrutiny. I think that the limitation, though, is that the Labour Party is trying to tread a careful line. They don't want to alienate the so-called red wall voters that they need to win back. So whilst listeners to this podcast probably feel profoundly opposed to the bill, I think we won't see that represented necessarily in Parliament quite as starkly.
No, do you think there'll be enough pushback to make any sort of difference, to make any changes happen?
I don't think there will in the Commons. Of course, it has to get through the Lords, and that tends to be where the sort of sanity filter is applied, which is ironic because, you know, this unelected house of aristocrats and retired politicians at the moment is doing a reasonably good job of applying sanity checks to insane legislation.
So there are protests happening against this, but this is clearly a government which either doesn't care about or doesn't really know how to read public opinion. Do you feel that people are a little bit powerless at the moment?
I don't think there's much to be done. I think in the end, that the way that the public, and particularly those who are opposed, and we shouldn't forget, I think there are probably plenty of people who feel very strongly about the small boats issue, albeit, you know, they might not choose to respond in quite the way that this government has. I think the way that ordinary citizens can make a difference is actually in supporting things like the protests against removal flights, or even supporting in different ways these various legal actions. Because ultimately, what is so absurd about this bill is that it is almost certainly illegal under international law, which means it's illegal under British law, because, of course, you know, these laws are ones that we have written into our own legislation. So there will be some point fairly soon when the ECHR, you know, the European Court, which is not the EU court and the one that we still belong to the chagrin of some of the more headbanger tendency in the Tory party, will probably strike down elements of this bill. And that is, in a way, the thing that is the brake on this government that doesn't like to have brakes.
Right, on to the story that won't stop being a story despite feeling very much like it's not a story at all. We're going to have to talk about Gary Lineker. Can this keep rolling, Arthur?
I think this will keep running. It's almost as if the BBC didn't realise when they suspended Lineker that he's literally their top presenter, both in terms of what they pay him, but probably in terms of popularity. And if you think about it, if any major business that is reliant on certain key individuals then suspends that key individual, you know, if Erling Haaland is taken off from City's bench, you can't expect the team to perform at that level. And it's in a way, what's so absurd is that the BBC just assumed that everyone else would meekly carry on with their work when this extremely successful, highly effective, literally top billing presenter is publicly humiliated. And until the BBC, you know, the question of whether or not he broke guidelines feels to me like that's actually disappeared from being the question that matters anymore. But the question now is, how do you manage this sort of car crash of a self-inflicted wound?
Yeah, it feels like they can never think two steps ahead.
Yeah.
It seems really obvious that Ian Wright was going to say, I'm not going to do it as well, and Shearer would do the same, and then you know, any person who could possibly step into the void would be persona non grata for doing so. So why would you ever do it? It seems very, very strange to me. Do you get the sense that anyone is going to take the fall here? There's rumours about Richard Sharp. Do you think he could go?
Well, it would certainly feel absolutely appropriate that he should go, given that he's already in hot water over organising Boris Johnson's 800 grand loan and then basically misleading the public about it having done exactly that. However, the reason I think he won't go this week on this issue is that there's already an investigation underway on the subject of the loan. And it seems that Sharp is very tin-eared. You know, his performance in front of that committee a couple of weeks back suggested that he doesn't get that there's a problem. So I sense, I may be wrong, that he's going to try and tough it out. You could argue that Tim Davey should go, the Director General, who's the actual, you know, executive manager of the organisation, who, of course, is also has a very strong background in the Tory party. But I think that's very unlikely. So I suspect that no one that we've heard of is going to resign this week. But, you know, it's very easy to be wrong about these things.
Do you think it's going to be that sort of very bureaucratic defence we seem to be seeing at the minute from a lot of high-profile people, that they will wait out an investigation and then use the smallest hint of light in that to totally vindicate themselves for everything?
It seems to be exactly. I mean, it's strange, isn't it, Jarv? Because in normal life, if you screw up, you either think, can I get away with it, or do I apologise now? But if you're in public life, the standard response is, I need to wait for the results of the independent inquiry. And it doesn't matter what you've done, that's the answer.
Yeah, no one seems to have any mind of their own, despite being in power, to make up minds for people, you would assume. Indeed. Anyway. On the public opinion side of this, though, Lineker seems to have, he's been able to get people backing him when it comes to being able to share his views. But is it as clear cut that people actually support his sentiment?
Yeah, I don't think it is that clear cut. But in a way, that's not the point, because the government treats the population as if it's moronic. And they say, if you support the idea of cracking down on small boats, you will therefore regard Gary Lineker as an overpaid metropolitan elitist. And what it turns out is that the British people are perfectly capable of thinking, well, I don't necessarily agree with Gary Lineker on the small boats issue, but I think that he should be allowed to tweet his opinions. And furthermore, I haven't forgotten that he's an incredible footballer who made me very happy all the numerous times he won games for England. You know, and it's the British people are capable of this sort of thing. And I do think there's something very, very Tory elitist about the way they've handled this, because it's this talking down. It's an assumption that there's this sort of mass of simplistic working class angry people who respond to very simple sort of dog whistles. And it turns out that, you know, human beings are fairly sophisticated creatures, and we're capable of putting together these complex and sometimes contradictory ideas.
Is it revealing of their own shortcomings that they can't really put together particularly sophisticated ideas that they don't think anyone else can?
Well, I think it certainly is revealing of their patronising and frankly disrespectful attitude to particularly the so-called Red Wall, that they regard them as a bunch of sort of simplistic, slightly angry, kind of instinctive people who will respond to certain stimuli. And oddly enough, they probably think that Gary Lineker slightly fits into this category as well, this sort of snobbery of, well, he's just a footballer, forgetting that he's an extremely sophisticated media professional who probably has the best advisors and strategists that money can buy, because that's what we do know, is he has plenty of money.
Yeah, well, I mean, he runs a media company of his own, so clearly he's going to be quite well media trained, which they seem to have completely missed anyway. But it's budget week this week. So Jeremy Hunt, is he going to be happy that people might be distracted from this?
Probably, because this is one of those budgets that you don't want people to remember. I mean, people will remember the kamikaze budget for all the wrong reasons. But basically, if you're the Chancellor, you have the quiet budgets, which are not near an election, and then you have the pre-election giveaway budget. Now, the fact that that's a thing tells us so much that's wrong with British politics. But before we get into anything that complicated, the basic point is Hunt needs to get through the budget without causing too many scandals, you know, not too many interest groups discovering that their little tax break or their little benefit has been taken away. And hopefully the public will move on and not be too focused on the general point, which is that the cost of living crisis is still on us. The economy is still in a bit of a mess, not as much of a mess as it was last year. And, you know, the wider headwinds in the global economy are still there in terms of the war in Ukraine and lots of associated challenges that go with that.
Is there anything in particular we should be looking out for, even though it might be quite a boring budget, as you say?
Well, I think there's a few things. He does need to try to put some dynamism back into the British economy. Of course, since Brexit, there have been lots of good reasons for businesses not to operate here. But he can't do that through tax cuts. So there's things to do with, you know, how businesses can claim back certain sort of capital allowances and so on. But I think the really big thing is actually trying to get people back to work. And there is this whole back to work push. Because as we know, a lot of people left the labour market after COVID. And thanks to the post-Brexit immigration setup, it's very hard for employers to bring new workers in from outside the UK. So we have a labour market crisis, as we all know. Walk down any street and you'll see signs begging people to, you know, apply for jobs in whether it's in shops or restaurants or whatever. But again, one of the reasons that people have left the labour market is that years of Tory policies have made it increasingly unattractive to work at the lower, particularly at the lower ends of the labour market, the sort of gig economy and that sort of thing.
Why is Hunt so under the radar generally? Is there a wider story going on here? You know, basically that Sunak was kind of lumped with him because he came in to replace Kwasi Kwarteng and then he couldn't really ditch him, but now he doesn't really need the sensible factor in the same way trusted. Is there a wider story that reveals something about the Conservative Party to us, sir?
Well, I certainly think it reveals a government that is not very likely to win the next election. And they know that. And it doesn't mean they've given up. You know, to be fair, I think Sunak is doing quite a lot of stuff. And you have to give him credit for sort of trying his best. But I think Hunt himself, I don't know what his sort of deepest inner ambitions are. Obviously, he's tried to be Prime Minister more than once. But I think he must know that that ship has probably sailed. And that's not a bad position to be in if you're a Chancellor, because a Chancellor who's constantly scheming to become Prime Minister, whether it's Gordon Brown or whether it's in more recent years, someone like George Osborne, is always a problem because they're always trying to upstage the PM. Whereas actually, Hunt, he knows that the best thing he can do is to be seen as somebody who stabilised the British economy after a complete car crash period with Kami Kwasi. So in that sense, being under the radar is probably very good for Hunt's wider brand, but also it's probably quite good for the British economy.
There would have been a nice bit of poetic justice, though, wouldn't there, surely, if Sunak had a scheming Chancellor who really wanted to be Prime Minister after having been one himself. Would have been a little bit of a kicker.
Well, it certainly, you know, history does have a habit of repeating itself. And as I say, you know, Hunt has tried to become Prime Minister more than once. So we shouldn't rule out that he's still got ambition in him. He's not an old man, you know, but I think it's certainly not a short term option for him. And I suppose that's the thing.
On a side note here, how worrying is the Silicon Valley Bank collapse for us here in the UK?
Yeah, this is very interesting. And for listeners who not necessarily followed the story, this is a specialist US bank that, as the name suggests, was very much embedded with the tech sector in California, but spread its wings more widely. And one of the things that you often would hear about the US tech sector was how good it was at funding startups, at getting finance for businesses that may not turn a profit for several years. Well, that business model has hit a crunch with the combination of high interest rates and a general slowdown in the tech sector, a lot of kind of investors losing faith in some of the, you know, the more kind of whizzy tech companies. And so the bank, Silicon Valley Bank, basically collapsed. Now, its main branch is in the US, but it has a significant business here as well. And it's been taken over by HSBC. That's the news here on Monday morning. Now, the question is, you know, what are the wider implications of this? Well, you've got a huge amount of venture capital, private equity money that's flowed into this sector. And as we all know, some tech businesses run for years without turning a profit and very much depend on the faith of their backers, you know, to keep pouring money into them. So this, it's quite possible to believe that you could have a bit of a contagion and people across the different sectors that invest in tech sort of scratching their heads and thinking, are we overexposed here? Do we need to draw in a little? Now, I don't think I'm not an investment specialist. People are saying this isn't at the scale of the 2008 financial crisis, which is good because that was pretty massive, but it's still a very significant part of the modern global economy. So I think it is quite troubling.
On a final domestic note, we've got junior doctor strikes happening at the moment. How much of a concern is this situation? Is there any chance of it being resolved swiftly, do you think, as well?
I'm not sure that there is. And I remember from the last junior doctor strike that people often don't realise that a junior doctor is almost every doctor except for the senior ones. And so, you know, it's a slightly misleading term. If you go to hospital, almost every doctor you see will be a so-called junior doctor. And so these are the absolute backbone of the kind of doctor workforce. And they were, as it happened under Jeremy Hunt, very mistreated during the last strike. And it's not always been the case that the senior doctors, the consultants, have always had their back. I say this as someone who at the time was married to a junior doctor, who, although she's now a consultant. I think there's sometimes a little bit of tension between the two levels. So it's not clear to me that this situation will easily be resolved. You've got huge pressures on that workforce. You know, that they're paid much better than nurses, but they still, after qualification, don't earn particularly large salaries. That the sort of famously well-paid doctors are much higher up the scale. And a lot of them have huge debts because they've been students for maybe 10 years or more. They have a lot of costs that they can't avoid. They have to keep current with exams and professional memberships, and they're supposed to pay for that. And ultimately, the NHS can be a pretty demanding employer. You know, they work incredibly long hours. So it's not clear how this is easily solved.
And while all this is going on, Sunak is off in the US, but it's not a jolly. He is meeting Joe Biden. What's emerging from that trip?
Well, it's a sort of trip that I was thinking this morning. This must be the trip that makes Boris Johnson so jealous that he's no longer prime minister, because the purpose of this trip is for the US, the UK and Australia to meet and chat about AUKUS, which, as we'll all remember, was that famous defence pact which got the French so upset because it involved making submarines for the Australians.
And
the Australians dropped the deal that they already had with the French. And of course, Boris Johnson would absolutely love this, striding the world, talking about big things like submarines, meeting leaders of other large Anglosphere countries, which is very much where Boris feels his natural environment. Now, of course, there's no reason why Rishi Sunak can't perform a solid role in that context as well. But what happens when you have those meetings is that the US side starts to ask fairly searching questions about the British defence budget. And instead of it being a big sort of parade of self-congratulation, the US side starts to say, well, Britain, are you really a serious defence partner for us? Because you've been cutting your defence budget. A lot of your kit doesn't seem to work. Your army is tiny. So we've got now, to add to the list of headaches going back to Jeremy Hunt's budget, they've got to find more money for the military at the same time as all the other things they've got to find money for.
What's he been saying about that defence budget side of things? I know he's announced a couple of other plans. What are they?
Well, he's pledged to increase defence spending by nearly 5 billion over the next 2 years. And that would be committing to a 2.5%, I think that's right. Yeah, 2.5% of GDP, which is over the 2% target, but way short of the kind of stretch target of 3%, which these days most people are saying has got to be a bare minimum. Now, Liz Truss, of course, had committed to 3%, although, you know, Liz Truss made all kinds of commitments, none of which were clear how she was going to do that. But But there's also going to be an updated integrated review, and that's a sort of the big defense and national security document. And it's very clear what's happened here. Some of us will remember Boris Johnson teasing the Defence Committee about the fact that tank battles in Europe were no longer a thing. And that was in 2021, November, if I recollect. Now, we all know how that particular prediction panned out. Yeah. We are in a world of major land warfare in Europe, and the British military just does not have the capability to deal with that. And you get what you always have, which is the different arms of the military, army, navy, air force, all sort of fighting like cats in a sack over who gets what slice of a rather small pie.
On US news, this seems like a question that's been asked forever, but let me ask it one more time. Arthur, is the law going to catch up with Donald Trump this week?
Oh gosh, wouldn't it be wonderful? There are so many things that he could and should face criminal sanctions for. Organising an insurrection feels like a pretty important thing. Trying to bully the election officials in Georgia into finding, as he called it, what was it, 11,000 votes? But it looks as though the thing that may catch him this week was paying hush money to the porn star Stormy Daniels. And this one goes way back before he was even president. And you'll recall that Stormy Daniels is a talented actress, we might say, in a particular genre. And she and Donald Trump had some kind of a relationship. And then she was paid off. And this is the thing.
Michael Cohen, right?
Yes, exactly. Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's sort of, at that time, wingman, bagman, was the person who paid the funds. Now, of course, since that time, the reason it might be illegal is that they used campaign funds to do so. And it is not conventionally seen as a legitimate use of political campaign funds to pay off the porn star you've been shagging. So whether or not this is the thing that finally catches Donald Trump, it would sort of have a delicious irony to it if this was the thing that finally got him. But of course, the US legal system is very kind to people with lots of money and expensive lawyers. So I don't think we can assume that it's all over for him.
Is there an issue that this could all add to the sort of Trump folklore, though? You know, if he's charged, but then he's not convicted, it lets him do this whole victim narrative of fighting against a deep state that's out to get him. And if that also then loops back around to being that it was because he was having relations with a very attractive woman, then that actually could boost him quite a lot as, you know, his sort of regular guy sticking it to the man shtick that he tries to go with.
Yeah, I think that's certainly, I'm sure, how he will try to respond, that he's a victim of the deep state and he's just a regular guy doing what any guy would do sort of thing. I guess that the limitation of that argument is one that if he actually faces criminal charges, it is less likely that the Republicans will select him as their presidential candidate. I'm not saying it's unlikely, because after all, everyone said it was unlikely last time and they did select him.
Yeah.
But it makes it less likely. And the other thing is that, you know, the victim narrative with the deep state paranoia, yes, that has a huge support base in the US. But let's not forget that Donald Trump is not very successful in elections. He's won one, his own, in 2016. All the other elections, whether it's midterms, his track record is pretty poor. So it seems to me that there's a small core of nutcases who think that Donald Trump's amazing and maybe he, you know, that some of them believe in QAnon and all kinds of fantasies. And then there's a bigger group of Republicans who would love to be shot of Donald Trump, but lack the backbone to do anything about it. And if he's taken off the scene for them by law enforcement, they might be quite glad of that.
And listeners, if you want to hear more about the future of the GOP, go back and listen to the Bunk USA that I did on Saturday. So it's a bit of self promo there. Arthur, finally, what's the latest from Ukraine?
Yeah, so the Battle of Bakhmut continues. I think we're into 7 months now. Bakhmut, as I'm sure everyone is now well aware, is a fairly small town in the Donbass of basically no strategic value that Russia has been pouring unbelievable resources into trying to take. And it has been the subject of a considerable discord between the main Russian military and the Wagner group, this, you know, mercenary unit run by Prigozhin, one of Putin's close associates. Now, we hear a lot about the losses that Russia has taken in trying to seize Bakhmut, and the Ukrainian strategy was to keep them busy in Bakhmut, losing equipment and men, and that stops them from doing anything anywhere else. But of course, we have to recall that that means the Ukrainians are also suffering losses there, that you can't defend without losses. And I think there's starting to be a little bit of nervousness around whether or not Ukraine has actually wasted resources in the defense of something that is of little value to them, when, of course, those resources are also limited for them. And it plays into a wider discussion, which is that we talk a lot about Russian casualties, and rightly so, because Russia has faced enormous casualties in a war that it started and, you know, a war that it failed to plan adequately for. But Ukraine has also suffered enormous casualties, and those figures are rarely accessible. And the Ukrainian government, understandably, but still, is very, very sensitive about a sort of, you know, discussion and articulation of those casualties. So the Bakhmut battle, whilst it is definitely tied the Russians down and caused them immense costs, we shouldn't forget that it's costing the Ukrainians as well.
This is a way off, but there are reports that Putin might go to the G20 in September. How are other nations going to react to that this week?
This is because the G20 will be hosted by India, which has taken no side on this conflict, really, between Russia and Ukraine. And they are trying to play the role of a non-aligned superpower in a world which is increasingly drifting into blocks, whether you're on a kind of Russia-Chinese bloc or a kind of US-Western bloc. I think if Putin does attend, you'll have lots of debate around how will Western leaders give him a cold shoulder whilst not offending their Indian hosts. But of course, as you say, it's still a long way off, and other things may happen between now and then. But it is a reminder that on the world stage, there's quite a lot of countries that, whilst they don't support Russia, don't feel actively opposed to Russia in the way that we do in the sort of NATO Western world. And it's good to be reminded of that.
Arthur, thank you for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And that's Start Your Week. If you enjoy The Bunker, remember you can back us on Patreon for £3 a month. You'll get episodes early and ad-free, as well as shout-out on this show. Here's Arthur with today's.
Well, our thanks to Jeremy Bate, Frank Chart, and Simon Mulvaney.
Thank you for listening. Come back tomorrow for another edition of The Bunker.
Start Your Week from The Bunker was written and presented by Jacob Jarvis with Arthur Snell. The producer was Kasia Tomashevich, and the audio producer was me, Jade Bailey. The lead producer is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.